This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 14th, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. We want to bring you, again, all the updates, things that have happened in the current weeks, and things that are going on that may be of interest to you as we come up here on the first corporate deadline. We also want to thank our State Society of CPA partners and those of you who have attended courses and support your state societies, because without them, we're not doing this. So I want to make sure you take a look as you get to the end of this tax season, you begin to look at your CPE year, and you begin to look at things like dues renewals. You want to make sure you take a look at your state societies. But let's go ahead and start looking at what's going to be happening this week in federal taxes, what did happen, and take a look at some of the news that took place. And we're going to start out with something that unfortunately was fairly predictable, although the IRS didn't anticipate it very well. The IRS this week announced on March the 7th, they are shutting down the online IP PIN recovery program. That is what the IRS, of course, the IP PIN was the numbers the IRS gave to taxpayers who had their identity stolen and who had false tax returns filed. Certain taxpayers received these notifications. The problem, of course, is that people from time to time lose these. In fact, according to statistics the IRS published, about 5% of the people who receive an IP PIN ended up going online trying to recover their IP PINs. Well, unfortunately, the IRS discovered that there were 800 returns had been filed fraudulently using a recovered IP PIN. So let's think about this for these people. They had already had an ID theft problem. They very possibly had already had a return that, you know, have already been through the mess once of having a fraudulent return filed on their account and had to wait all the time period to get that taken care of by the IRS. And now the very IP PIN that was supposed to stop that from happening again was compromised, quite likely by the same people who compromised their return last time. And now they're going to have another year's worth of fun to deal with this. And of course, these people are probably not the people that lost their IP PINs and had to go online. The problem is fairly simple. And unfortunately, this was a problem that had been pointed out to the IRS multiple times. That was that they were using the same flawed out-of-wallet verification questions as they had used in the online transcript system. That system, you remember last year, we talked about that just recently, where the IRS, where people had accessed their transcript information, over 700,000 people had their transcript information accessed because bad guys got in and were able to answer these out-of-wallet questions. Back when that happened last summer, you may remember we discussed briefly Brian Krebs in his Krebs on Security blog that we mentioned here before had specifically pointed out that the IP PIN recovery system used the same method and essentially pointed out that that was flawed and that that system should be just as much at risk as the transcript system. Significantly, the Treasury Inspector General's office also pointed out that the IP PIN system seemed to be subject to the same flaws as the system that was used for the transcripts. Finally, on February the 25th, Tax Analyst published an article discussing this problem. And in that article, an infamous last word was stated by the IRS, infamous statement that I'm sure the person who made it for the service would love to take back. But the IRS statement at that time was that the IP PIN system, while recognizing it used the same out-of-wallet information as the transcript system, they said, but there was no personally identifiable information provided by that system, as if that somehow justified continuing to use this method of getting information. Well, of course, not surprisingly, now the IRS has shut down the system. Now we go on to what happens. If you have a taxpayer who lost their IP PIN, they can no longer go online. And quite frankly, you might argue they never should have been able to go online to get this, but we'll skip that. Obviously, those people will be upset. Unfortunately, that's just the nature of it. We can have upset 5% or expose 95%. I happen to think the current math makes a little more sense, but nevertheless, that's your problem. If they lose their IP PIN, they're going to have to obtain one by direct contact with the IRS. However, the IRS did note that if somebody has moved since January 1st of 2016, because of the way they used to recover an IP PIN, they're going to go back to the address they had on file. and people who are trying to scam these would change addresses, those people will have to file a paper return. As pointed out, a paper return without an IP PIN, that is going to slow down dramatically the processing of the return. Therefore, what you want to tell clients now who get IP PINs is you absolutely need to warn a client that they may very well receive this, and when they do, they absolutely need to keep it. Any client that you have who's had an IP PIN, they need to make sure they keep it available. Do not assume it can be recovered. In fact, assume it's going to be a major hassle to get it recovered and potentially not possible to get. Now, it's easy to get upset and say, oh, can you imagine that, the government getting this bad? I mean, government agencies fouling up and losing data, that's horrible. Well, not to be outdone, a large private company also got taken in, somewhat interestingly, by the very scam the IRS warned about last week that we discussed. You may remember last week I discussed about a phishing scam that was asking for W-2 information from companies. They would send a phishing email to the HR department or the controller asking for copies of the W-2 sent to them in PDF by email. And it would appear to come from the CEO or some other high-ranking official, the CFO, somebody who it might reasonably appear might want that, and the person is not going to want to upset them by giving a slow response. Unfortunately, this week it was announced, Krebs on Security, and I'd like to not have to quote Brian anymore. I mean, Brian's articles are very interesting, very nice, but it'd be nice to get out of this for the moment, but we're not yet. Seagate Technology, the large hard drive maker, they fell victim to this. Interestingly enough, In their announcement, they claim they became aware of this on October 1st, the very day the IRS sent out the notices. Seems kind of interesting, and don't know if that's a coincidence. I suspect it's not. But nevertheless, they became aware of it. They received one of the emails. The IRS gave you three example emails. One of those was exactly, effectively, what Seagate got. The person who received it immediately sent a copy of all of Seagate's W-2s on every employee for 2015, was sent via email immediately, and that data is now in the wild. What this tells us, which I think is important and something I mentioned last week, this should point out very clearly that you can't rely on your own IT controls or your IT guy or your anti-malware software to block these things. It's fairly obvious that an organization the size of Seagate will have full-time IT professionals. They'll have people there whose job is security. The catch is these things bypass all of that. The fact is Seagate mailed out, you know, that bypass, that email got all the way in. It looked like it was coming from the CEO. It, you know, all of these things passed it. Now, I'm sure now we're going to have filters in place and organizations like that that will check if an email appears to have a from address that's the name of a corporate officer. They'll make sure it's coming from an internal address, but that may cause problems with the officers who may sometimes, it's not just former secretaries of state, let's say, who use their private email addresses sometimes, but sometimes CEOs do. And so that'll be an interesting aside how all that goes. But the key thing to remember is we are seeing an uptick. And this week, we've also had reports on the California listserv of an uptick with a number of people getting these, oh, yes, here's an organizer you requested, et cetera, that type of email. The scammers are trying to get around all the filters and everything you have. Unfortunately, they're getting very good at doing that. You have to be skeptical of every email you receive. That's unfortunately a fact of life now. Be aware of that because people are going after your data. Next up, well, quoting Yogi Berra, it's deja vu all over again. Notice 2016-22. This was issued here on March 7th. Yet again, the IRS announces procedures to deal with the congressional tardiness in extending the Work Opportunity Tax Credit. As you may recall, when you ever dealt with this credit, this is where you must submit a request for pre-certification when you hire somebody to get this credit. Of course, that's a problem considering that the credit didn't exist for most of last year, so the state agencies couldn't issue pre-certifications because there was nothing to certify against. Congress, as it did the prior year and as it's done before, retroactively extended this provision. So now suddenly the credit's available for 2015 for people you hired that meet the criteria, but of course, nobody's pre-certified. So the IRS yet again has given us a relief provision pretty similar to what we saw last year with slightly different dates. you must submit a request for certification to the state agency by June 29th of 2016. You have to do that. Now, the interesting aside is that covers both people who meet the 2015 rules, but also we added this year the long-term unemployed. Because the long-term unemployed is a new category, the IRS has decided that some people may have hired people already this year who met that requirement, but they just weren't aware that that was now one of those things they're supposed to get pre-certification for. So they're also going to allow you to submit for 2016 certifications all the way through June 29th for anybody you hired in 2016. Again, generally, you must have the certification before you take the credit on the return. So if you have, or you're coming up now on that corporate filing deadline and you find out that the corporation is eligible to claim the credit this year, this probably means you better start getting the extensions ready because you want to extend and hopefully you'll get that approval back before the September 15th. Otherwise, you can file the return without the credit, then of course go back and amend to claim the credit. But this is simply a repeat of what we've had for the past couple of years. Next up, we go into an interesting issue that we run into. Lots of times we get and we've discussed multiple times the concepts of substance over form. All of us who've been in tax matters for a while have known that issue. But the issue you need to understand, we're going to take a look at the case of Macrick Enterprises versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-44. This is the case where we see the difference between when a taxpayer attempts to argue substance over form versus when the IRS does. Generally, under a rule called the Danielson Rule, based on a case from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, a taxpayer normally is not allowed to challenge the substance, raise a substance over form argument related to their own agreement, unless the taxpayer can show basically one of two things. Number one, that the contract is ambiguous. Let's say the agreement's ambiguous. Well, in that case, it's not really substance over form. We're saying the form is unknown. And if we properly interpret the form under state law, the form can be interpreted then in line with its substance. We'd consider the substance of the transaction and intent and all those other things in interpreting the language of the contract when it's ambiguous. Or if it's not ambiguous, then we have to show that we could bring an action in state court to reform the contract, even if the other side objected, and that we would win that reformation suit. So basically, here's where the problem came. And this one is a case of you got to feel sorry for the people because this ended up costing us well over $1 million in excess tax, probably well over much more than that, at least probably a couple million, because the IRS in this case was only looking at the corporation's liability. And the shareholders, as the court points out in the footnote, probably had another significant liability that's going to be triggered by this transaction. Macrick Enterprises was a holding company. It had no real activities except it held the stock of a subsidiary. The subsidiary was the active company. A buyer came in who wanted to buy the business run by the subsidiary. Now remember, Macrick had no other activities. All Macrick did was own the sub stock. So the idea they came up with originally, they wanted to get long-term capital gain treatment at the shareholder level. And the buyer was actually agreeable to this. So the buyer's willing to buy stock. And these are C corporations. It's a consolidated group. Their original plan was to liquidate the parent company and then to go ahead and distribute the subsidiary stock to the shareholders and have the shareholders sell the subsidiary stock. I'm not sure why that structure was chosen, what the point was, what the deal was. And we don't know their theory about why that was going to work to get them long-term gains. The only thing we found out, though, somewhere before the deal was executed, their outside accountant looked at the deal, and he told them he was concerned that that stock distribution to them would not get a carryover holding period, so that when they liquidated the parent and gave them the sub stock, that their holding period would start on the date they received it from the parent. That, of course, would be bad because that would generate short-term capital gains. So they decided, wait, we want to restructure this deal. Now, the court made no comment on the original structure, nor did the court make any comment on whether that structure would have generated the long-term capital gains requested. All we know is they got cold feet. They wanted to change now. So what they did, they decided that instead of this, they would go ahead and sell the parent and then have, you know, and the buyer would then get the parent with the sub in the parent, and the, you know, the buyer could then do what they wished. Unfortunately, what happened was they gave some emails back and forth. They gave a couple of emails where they thought they had informed the other side about how to restructure the deal. Unfortunately, the email that actually gave that statement, they sent it, they had no record that it was ever acknowledged being received. The buyer's attorney drafted an agreement for the sale, and he gave a draft of that to the other side. After the date, the idea of the change of the agreement came through, that went back and forth 11 times. Unfortunately, all 11 of those provided that Macrick, the parent company, would be the seller of the stock, and what would be sold was the subsidiary stock. 11 straight agreements had it written that way, including the final agreement that they signed. They failed to notice, in essence, that the agreement did not provide for a sale of the parent, but rather the agreement was still selling the subsidiary stock, and all the attorney for the other side did was change the seller from what was essentially the shareholders, the individual shareholders, to the parent company. The taxpayers, again, that nobody noticed this until the IRS exam. The outside CPA had prepared the return, assuming that the parent company stock was sold. The outside CPA did that because the CFO assured him that the deal was structured so that the, you know, the stock of Macrick was sold. And it wasn't until the IRS pulled the return for exam, took a look at the agreement, the agent came back and asked the obvious question. Why wasn't the sale of the sub by the parent recorded on the parent's return? Because the parent, according to this agreement, sold the stock of the sub. So now they're trying to say, well, substance over form. The tax court, while agreeing that there's no question the sellers intended for it to be done that way, noted that it was never obvious that the buyer understood this difference or that the buyer had agreed to it. They pointed out a number of issues here. Number one, they said the agreement was utterly unambiguous. 11 straight drafts went back and forth. They all said this. There's no ambiguity, no last-minute drafting error. This went back and forth multiple times, including subject to final reviews. The buyer did their due diligence review only on the subsidiary company. They didn't look at the parent, which they would have changed their due diligence, presumably had they understood they were buying the parent. And they pointed out, you signed it. You have to live with the nature of this agreement. What this points out is a couple of things. Number one, not sure how the error occurred, but it seems like if you look at the outside account and the CFO, I expect everybody in this loop thought somebody else had checked and made sure this had happened. I am certain everybody else thought somebody else took care of it. The problem is, of course, everybody made those assumptions and the assumption was wrong. Also, it's very important to understand that substance over form is a one-way street. As the Danielson rule points out, you can't get there from here. If you sign an agreement and it has bad consequences that you didn't notice till after you signed it, you're stuck with that. The service is allowed to change it because they weren't a party to the negotiations. That's the key difference. To illustrate a bit of a difference, let's take a look at a second case that came out the day after, Milan and Subsidiaries versus Commissioner, another case where this time the IRS again raised Danielson. But in this case, IRS didn't win. This was a case of a company that entered into a licensing agreement with a foreign entity that had developed a drug. They were going to import the drug, have marketing rights, etc., in the United States and Canada. They were allowed to enter into a sub-license with the approval of the foreign entity, which they did. Now, that sub-license, fine, in 2001 was there. In this case, Mylan had a lot of work they were doing in addition to the sub-licensee who would actually sell the drug. However, a couple of years later, they needed additional cash. They also wanted to do new acquisitions. They wanted to improve their credit rating. So they went back and they made modifications to that sub-license agreement. That modifications pretty much took away all of Mylan's rights with some limited exceptions. There was like a 1%. They got a 1% interest on all the sales that came in from overseas, and they were to assist in making sure that that the sub-licensee could negotiate with the foreign company because they're going to try to get everything transferred. They also were still required to make payments under the original agreement, but the sublicensee agreed essentially to give them the money. They were just forwarded on to the foreign company. The IRS said, well, wait, it still says it's a licensing agreement, so your payment should be ordinary income, and you didn't sell your rights, which would assume also that we don't get basis against it. The taxpayer said, no, this was actually a sale of all of our rights. In this case, the court found this was not an attempt to revise it after the fact. And part of the reason was the court in this case says the agreement itself was ambiguous. They pointed to a series of cases in the medical area where we had looked at these license agreements, that it was normal in the industry for selling all rights to still be referred to as licensing agreements. And for that reason, the court said they were not arguing change, you know, reinterpret the contract, you know, and treat it as if we signed a different document, which, by the way, is what they were arguing in the earlier case. Rather, in this case, they're saying, no, this contract as written is properly interpreted as a sale. The court didn't hold that it was. This was a motion for summary judgment, but they held that that was a factual matter and that, in essence, there was enough of a factual question that it was not appropriate to give the IRS this judgment as a matter of law, but rather that they're okay to go to trial. Now the parties will argue whether or not this particular agreement truly was a sale or whether it was simply a license agreement. But the court held that it is possible it's a sale, and because of that, the IRS could not win summary judgment. Finally this week, something else coming up. The IRS now this week, notice 2016-23, asked for guidance on the new regulations for the partnership audit regimes. In essence, the IRS said, look, this year in 2016, partnerships this year could elect to be under the new rules. In fact, if you had a late year formed partnership last year, you could on a 2015 return do it. Don't know if many people are going to do that. But because of that, the service said we need to get guidance out by the end of the year. Now, they did say, essentially, one thing they will get out relatively early is guidance on how you can make the early election on 2016 returns. So the idea of how we're going to make that election, that's coming out soon. They're not asking for guidance on that. They plan to release that before they release these proposed, temporary, and whatever type of regulations we'll get. But they are asking for guidance in some specific areas. If you download the information from our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, you'll find out a lot more information about what they're looking at. It's interesting to look at the questions they're asking because that gives you some information about what type of guidance they're going to bring forward and potentially what that guidance might have. They're looking for guidance specifically in a number of areas that they list here on this particular structure. First, they're looking for guidance on the 100 partner election out. How do we, you know, what other entities should we allow besides the ones that are in there? Now, in a conference, tax analysts had a conference earlier this week with the IRS and various practitioners in D.C. where they discussed, where they were discussing these rules with the people at the IRS who are going to be involved in writing them, as well as various other parties. And one of the things the service made very clear is the point of these regulations is to simplify the audit process for the IRS. So you have to assume that regulations are going to be written in such a way to keep it simple. Simple means, unfortunately, though you need to remember, that it's much simpler for the service to audit just the partnership and not to potentially have to open 100 exams on individuals or 99 exams on individuals with 99 potentially different results. So because of this, you know, I would not expect the IRS to expand this list widely. However, again, the idea is to give them comments about ones that would be appropriate, understanding that their goal is to keep it simple. So you may end up wanting to say, if you want to give comments on this, which, by the way, there's an email address to send them to that's also in the article that's on the website and in the download PDF we'll have an option for here. You can go ahead and, you know, send that request there, but keep in mind, don't just say, you know, you need to add all of these things, because that's pretty much, they've already told us they're going to reject it if you just say add everything. Other thing we're going to look, they also want to know some information about how they should go about computing the imputed underpayment, and they want to specifically look at whether they should consider certain specialized cases of income types. That's interesting because the actual rule didn't seem, you know, the law seemed to make just a simple straight across the board calculation. IRS may look at changing that calculation some, so we'll try to work on how that one will go. They also want to know some of the ways mechanically that we're going to use the alternative method where we elect to have the partners push the adjustment out to the individual partners instead of having the partnership pay the tax. You want to keep your eye on these changes. These are significant changes. We need to be aware of them. We're going to be receiving guidance during this year. So there's good news. Somewhere during the year, we're going to get this guidance. And that guidance is going to probably continue to come all the way up through the 2018 date. If you've not spent time looking at this yet, first thing you want to put on your reading list after tax season is to start looking at these details and contacting your partnership clients, because on paper, it certainly appears that every partnership agreement should at least be considered for modification, even the smallest, because as we mentioned, we've done the sessions here, we've talked about on this podcast, the opt-out method, you know, the new methods. The new methods are automatically apply unless a partnership opts out, and a late filed return, you can't opt out. So every partnership potentially may be subject to this. And if a partnership ever gets a partner like a trust that's not on the list of entities that can opt out, then it'll be in on its own. So every agreement's going to have to provide for how we handle these odd situations. So this has been the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 14th, 2016. Current federal tax developments is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. Be sure to visit us on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we keep our updates. Also there, we're going to have this audio and video podcast is available. You'll also find there, I'm going to link you to a written PDF that has all the articles related to this week so that you've got all those things in one place. If you want to go read them or, you know, share them with your partners, et cetera, that's available for you. Also, be sure to check your State Society of CPAs catalogs for our live upcoming sessions that we'll have. That'll be coming up as we finish up this tax season. So as those begin to come out, you begin to plan your CPE year, I hope you'll consider us and consider your state societies, because as I said, that's how we pay for this and that's how we keep all this going. Be sure to check online with us during the week for updates and join us next week as we come up with and we discuss the developments that occur in the coming week in the area of federal taxes.